But tonight you've made me ashamed of every concept I ever had of superior or inferior beings. But I thank you for that shame. Because now I know that we are each of us a separate human being, Brandon, with the right to live and work and think as individuals, but with an obligation to the society we live in. By what right do you dare say that there's a superior few to which you belong? By what right did you dare decide that that boy in there was inferior and therefore could be killed? Did you think you were God, Brandon? Is that what you thought when you choked the life out of him? Is that what you thought when you served food from his grave? I don't know what you thought or what you are, but I know what you've done. You've murdered! You've strangled the life out of a fellow human being who could live, love, as you never could. Never will again. It's not what I'm going to do, Brandon. It's what society's going to do. I don't know what that will be, but I can guess.
Hello and welcome to Cavaliers Do Cinema. I'm Zara.
I'm Crippy.
All right, tonight we're doing another classic, Alfred Hitchcock's.
Hitchcock's.
Yeah. I actually have removed some homosexual imagery from the podcast, which is the exact opposite of what we'll be doing for the rest of it. Because
that's all you're going to get.
This is the gayest Hitchcock film ever made.
And that's not said as like a derogatory statement. It's just quite simply quite gay.
It's very gay.
It's got some, well, in subtext and sometimes quite literal.
But, you know,
we will get into that.
I mean, yes. I don't think anyone disagrees that there's a lot of homoerotic subtext in this film. However, we may push the boundaries a bit and... you know, read some things into some lines that probably weren't intended and some people might find a bit offensive.
Champagne out of martini glasses. Yeah, about that. Obvious gay reference there. Yeah, totally. But, you know, draw some long bows.
There are some dirty things coming. But I think they're semi-legitimate to what we're talking about. So we're not just being... we're not just jumping onto the easiest gay joke we can.
Hang on.
Before we actually start the podcast proper, so I don't have to go back and record a little intro again.
We're going to swear our tits off.
No, not that. That's fine. Right. iTunes takes care of it.
Oh, okay.
You know, we've got the explicit warning.
Oh, okay.
I think I've already dropped an F-bomb.
Oh.
Fuck. No. The thing I was going to say is, first of all, we're going to spoil the film. Which, I don't know, seeing as you see who killed him in the first 5 minutes, that shouldn't be too much of a problem.
Who's this Hitchcock guy?
But more importantly than just spoilers, we're going to talk about this as if you've seen the film. It's not going to make much sense otherwise. And the other important thing, we'd love to hear what you have to say, if indeed there is anyone listening. We just put the Mulholland Drive podcast up today, so...
Yep, so we're now an actual thing that exists.
Yeah, so we will try and do this better this time. we're doing a bang-up job so far.
Okay, let's get into it.
So,
Rope, how did you feel during? Yeah.
Oh.
We've already started.
Oh.
Yep.
Before I start... picking up on all those little homosexual moments there. This is one of my favorite Hitchcock films.
Oh, absolutely. I'd probably go as far as saying it's my favorite Hitchcock. Maybe North by Northwest personally. But
yeah, no, I'm more into the kind of closed psychological thrillers than those espionage.
I'll take Cary Grant myself.
yeah, that's a funny one.
Jimmy Stewart's a legend.
Rope is like the cult within the Hitchcock cult.
Yeah, it absolutely
is. It's funny.
It's the most experimental, and it's also, you know, like I can't really.
Well,
when you think about the context of it, and Hitchcock being the kind of director he is, but the names that he had attached to this, I mean, there's Jimmy Stewart and everything, and there's Farley Granger, but Cedric Hardwicke, I think, who plays Mr. Kentley, David's father in it, he was, you know, reasonable at the time as well. So the fact that, you know, they had such big names, and it's still so so ridiculously unique and experimental.
But then again,
to be commended,
Hitchcock's because language of cinema has taken so much from Hitchcock that it's hard to look back and see some of his most well-known mainstream films are pretty experimental. Psycho is experimental. The birds is experimental.
But he basically invented, I mean, amongst other things, invent the title sequence as well. Well, Saul Bass invented the title sequence.
Yeah.
But that's...
And this is a really weird title sequence.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very cheery, sunny. But that's
I think it's non-diegetic music in the entire thing, where you've got the music kind of, which is this jangly little upbeat number, and you're that's just like,
true, actually, there is earth? No, yeah.
And that's it. Like, it is a very claustrophobic environment, and it does betray its theatrical origins with, you know, nobody leaves the set apart from that very first shot, which kind of pans up to a window and then you hear the scream. No. And then from there on, it is inside that set. And so I think that's a very good thing that there is no music outside of it, because it does really kind of trap you in there with them.
And it both really embraces its... theatrical origins, but also plays with them. A lot of people,
and I think that's really clear in the long take aesthetic of it.
Yeah, yeah, and
it's very clear.
which is both sort of the most faithful to a theater experience, yet at the same time
that you'd get in the cinema,
the furthest you can get from it as well.
Yeah,
and using the medium of film,
to the
advantage that you never could on stage, and also the way that. Characters and conversations fade out into the background, which is obviously a cinematic technique. And I've read some of this film's detractors kind of say, "Well,
I'm curious to see what they did."
Well, I mean, they just consider it a minor Hitchcock film. I mean, I disagree, but there's a lot of great films, so I'm not losing sleep over it. But
I mean, I haven't seen Marnie, which is what everyone says is the best.
Really? Who told you Marnie was the best Hitchcock film?
I don't know.
It's fun because Sean Connery gets to be a misogynist prick through it, and Hitchcock abuses Tippi Hedren more. But if you can get past that, it's very good. And it is the biggest matte background, I think.
This is the biggest. Oh well, maybe up to that point.
I'm pretty
sure Rope is the biggest.
He built a fucking street. He built like a street with a pier and a ship at the end of it. So
yeah,
I'm gonna say money. But going back to this, I think the detractors said this is just a kind of interesting little experiment in trying to replicate the theatre experience on film, which I think it's not true. It's selling it short, but it's an interesting take.
I think the biggest kind of only kind of bother that I have with it, and I think that really does prove true in that respect, is that it is like he's so professional, is Hitchcock, and he's so much about that he never breaks the line at any point. And it is that betrays the fact that it's in a soundstage. And
I think that's true of all of Hitchcock's films.
And I mean, like, with long takes, I think that's the kind of one thing that a master or somebody not breaking the rules can break the rules, in the sense that they can break the line and go 360. But he's just like, no. No, we're gonna.
Hitchcock will always choose control over realism. That's the one. Yeah. That's the one constant in his films. He will. I don't think he ever went outside.
Yeah,
in his last films, he probably did. I haven't seen those very, very late pictures, but
pictures.
Yes,
we're definitely just.
We're in Hitchcock mode now. I think he wants so much control over the look and feel of the film that the matte paintings and the rear screen projections and all those aspects of this film, which are just as they're no longer flaws, or they're no longer
they ground them in a certain time, and it's
but not only a certain time. I mean, it's him, and the way he uses them is a real art unto itself. And interesting, just to go off on another tangent, a recent episode of Mad Men used the rear screen projection, and Mad Men's done as a very realist show, but they've embraced that aspect. I mean, it was used widely throughout the film.
Did they shoot it on 16mm, or was it all digital?
I'm not sure. I wouldn't be surprised.
If they went like an entire episode, it was kind of back to that. But yeah, anyway, Hitchcock.
Yeah. So I think people have absorbed that as part of the canon, so to speak.
Absolutely, yeah. I think also just one thing on the long unbroken scenes, I mean, that are obviously quite theatrical. My focus was at no point on that, and no point did I think, this is a stage play. I mean, it took me a little while to kind of get to that, and, you know, once... You know, nobody really leaves the apartment, then that becomes obvious. But for me, my focus, you know, I think people will kind of come to realize this if they listen to us continuously. Long takes, one is tracking shots just make me jizz. And you will, Asaro is very aware of this. Any long take in anything is just enough. If there's a good long take in something,
he looks like it, Brandon at the start of Rogue.
I get that little
the oval mouth, and he has to light up a cigar. He's sweating.
It's like, oh man, just long takes. Seriously, I go absolutely.
I agree, but. But in
static
this
long
film,
takes not so much, but you
the
know,
long takes
the movement, and also there are just a couple of shots that there's one that repeats, and I pointed this out to you as well. There's this one shot where they're kind of walking around the chest in which David's body is hidden,
yeah,
and it's at the very beginning, and they're kind of walking around, I said, oh, I wonder if that shot's going to get repeated, and then it does when they're all finally starting to realize, like, well, David's late, where is he? And There's like the candles and the books and all the food and the tablecloth, and it's all still there, and you see her like
it's really long.
And you can see her going into the kitchen and then coming back, and she does like two trips, and the whole time you're just like, oh my god! Like, you can just see, like, in certain cinemas, probably in America, that, you know, people would just be shouting out, "Well, where is David? He's in the chest, you fucking idiots!"
Yeah, I agree that's a great
can't
scene.
Hear you, but that is
and you don't and you don't now, hear it all goes just in. You know, they're talking about Dave and where he could be. I don't remember a single example of where could he be at the club. Could he be
they said like, oh, he might have met up with somebody at the bar.
I just stopped paying attention and was looking intently at what she was doing.
You just hear David every now and again. You just hear, where's David?
I've seen this film so many times. Yeah, I mean, I know what's going to happen, so it's not that aspect. It's just the focus on where the action is. But let's go back to the start.
Just quickly.
Yeah.
Okay, just on that note, like, of that, body in the chest, just using that as a general kind of idea of Hitchcock's, I think it is something that really separates it, and really this film could have been a mystery, and I think lesser directors could have gone, it's a mystery, but there's a difference between mystery and suspense.
It would
suspense.
Have been pretty
bad. I know, yeah, see, that's the thing, and this is I've seen
this, I don't think this film could have been a mystery.
Okay, yeah, see, there's this interview with Hitchcock, and he says there's mystery and there's suspense. He says, mystery, okay, five people are sitting around a table talking about baseball. It's very dull. All of a sudden, a bomb goes off, blows all the people to smithereens. What you've got there is 5 minutes of a scene, which is, you know, pretty boring. And then you've got a 5-second payoff, and the audience doesn't give a shit. Take that same scene, show the audience that there's a bomb under the table, and all of a sudden, the scene becomes incredibly vital. And yeah, that, like, that for me encapsulates this entire film in a nutshell.
Yeah, it does.
It is just so many people could learn from that.
And actually, it's interesting. You know, it's the Hitchcockian suspense blown up to a whole film. Because, I mean, you know, he'd use this sort of device in one scene or one particular moment to move from point A to point B in a story. But in this, he takes that moment and blows it up to an entire feature-length film where... where we know what's happened, we basically know where the story's going, and we're just waiting for it to all come out. And it's the entire film. And that's the reason the film just flies by, because it's such a small film.
The first watch does not fly by. The first watch in no way flies by. It's absolutely excruciating. I watched this like only a year ago, and it was on the recommendation of a friend, and he said, I felt physically ill watching this because these guys are just so sickening. Yeah. And you just watch it, and that shot that I just described where they're talking about David, it's just like a minute or two, and then they nearly open the chest, and then Brandon stops them. And it's like 2 minutes, and you just like, just open the chest. Like that, I mean, the fact that these two dudes are just off on their like superiority trip the whole time just kind of makes it even worse. You're just kind of terrified of these two dudes and absolutely disgusted by them. And then you're kind of feeling sorry for everyone else there who's obviously going to have their lives significantly altered by the discovery when it does come out.
Yeah.
And it's just absolutely... That first watch is absolutely excruciating. It does not feel like an hour and 17 minutes. It feels a lot longer, and you just...
Well, time sort of stands still.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's not even... You don't even measure it in time.
You can't
It doesn't go past us quickly or slowly. It just... It's sort of... It's this constant moment. But as you're talking about the never-ending... The continued
shot.
Not opening of the... I know it's more eloquent way to say that. But, you know, I think we should get all the homoeroticism out of the way in one go. So look, for me, I don't really feel we need to bring up why we think that this is a gay relationship and why this is a very sexual act, this killing, because it's so overt at the start.
Yeah.
And they're obviously so effeminate in their manner that this is clearly the intention of Hitchcock. And you know, if
the first 5 minutes after they do it,
it's post-coital.
It's post-coital.
There's the lighting of the cigarette. There's basically...
There's a line, how did you feel during? And it's just like...
Well, I want to go through all the lines I think...
You took... I
took notes of the dirty lines. And some of these I'd like to add I don't think are intentional. They become... Which is good. That's always interesting to sort of do the the
accidental
interpretation.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And it's the Freudian awesome subtext, you know?
Yeah, and they're talking about Freud constantly.
Yeah, exactly.
You never do anything by accident.
And particularly after our Mulholland Drive discussion, this feels, you know, creating the subtext from the character.
Yeah.
This one is... And so there's a line where I think it's after the girlfriend of David.
Yeah.
Janet. Described in the credits as David's girl.
David's girl.
she sees this weird setting of the of where David's body is and why they haven't used the table, and she says, "How queer." There's just a little one, but my favorite is Brandon's asked, what's wrong with
Philip?
With Philip.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, he's just a little bit tight. Now, look, I think that's a completely innocent line at the time. To me, I just love this secondary reading that, yes, you see, we're gay lovers and I'm the dominant partner. And when we engage in anal sex, you see, he tightens up.
It's just a little bit tight.
That's a great use of the line. It's
aged quite well for the reading.
Exactly. That's why I love it. But it's mainly that whole opening scene has the most sexual subtext, and then of course there's the continued effeminate nature, which you know you want to.
And it's
for sensitivity's sake, you want to avoid kind of saying that.
It's not so much effeminate than just bloody hammy. And this is something that dates it incredibly. And it makes you more conscious of just how good Jimmy Stewart is. Because Jimmy Stewart seems so naturalistic and he's just so wonderful on screen. But these
that
other guys are just
that
like,
works
they're
for
all
the characters as well.
Yeah. But
though,
like these other dudes... Yeah, but
the fact that he's cooler
much.
In his skin than the other characters makes sense for that character, I thought.
Yeah, but you can see it in every Jimmy Stewart role. He's just got a very
naturalistic kind of... There's a reason he's the great actor of his generation.
But like, just with the orgasm sound, and that is something that really just settles it. Every time he thinks about murder, every time he feels like he's gotten away with his act of superiority, it's just a little...
needs to like, have a smoke. Also, his constant need for control... Mm-hmm. We get the bizarre subplot of he's got to set these two up. It's just kind of like, why is he doing this? I get it. It's just a game to him. Human relationships.
And there's that line of, why can't he just keep his hands off people? And you're just like,
there's that. Relevant, there's lots of puns within it. I wrote hubris puns. You know, is it a birthday? Well, it's quite the opposite. And you know, your chances are much better now. I actually wrote a few lines into my notes. The sex metaphor is too large. I can't take notes, and I stopped taking notes. Literally, because the first 5 lines are just all the sexual readings of it, because it's so strong.
Yeah, no, no.
But it works. It works. And also this will be my last point about the homosexuality of it, or the homoeroticism, I should say. That's more accurate.
Homoerotic subtext.
Yeah. Oh, is it subtext?
Okay, see, text.
This is my point. If this movie was released today, I think it would have a higher rating because the implicit references, I actually think, are more explicit today. I'm not saying that the audience of the 40s wouldn't have got that. I think it's very clearly there. But now it would be way more overt and you wouldn't want your kids seeing this, because I reckon about the age of 8 you could go, Mommy, are they gay?
Yeah.
Then again.
That's a... certain kind of 8-year-old.
Yeah.
kind of 8 year old.
Who's and you know, quite frankly, if you were taking your kids to rope and the biggest problem you have with it is that they're gay and not that they're killing people out of some misconstrued Darwinian God complex, you're fucked up. You're fucked up. Anyway, but my last point is, does Brandon want to impress Rupert out of a romantic or a sexual love, or out of a need to please him as a father figure? Both are very Freudian.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it basically comes down to the way you see the protege mentor relationship.
It's got that Spartan thing going on.
Well, yeah, but it doesn't. Ultimately, I think in a way he kind of wants to outdo him a little bit because he says he's got the ideas and he's brilliant, but we are doers and we act.
But once he arrives, he clearly is just dying to impress him.
Oh, he's so sycophantic. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and he wants him to discover the murder. It's like almost a dog bringing in a dead bird. Yeah. You know? Look at what I did. I followed your advice.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you can see the kind of impact that Rupert had on his life. And like, obviously had some kind of influence on the formative... kind of at a formative age. And see, that's what's interesting to me, because like, why can't he keep his hands off people, just like as a kind of line for just the way Brandon kind of manipulates Kenneth and Janet, but also his like, and that's almost something that positions us to kind of think that the whole thing's a metaphor for just kind of elements of it are a metaphor for kind of influencing other people, like in ways that they don't understand. And particularly when you think about that in the context of Brandon being influenced in this kind of theoretical idea by Rupert, and then Rupert kind of comes along and goes, oh shit, fuck, I can't believe this is the outcome of my kind of little...
That ties into my next
theoretical
big point.
Kind of ideas. I mean, yeah.
But before I get to that one, I just want to add one last thing about the characters on a personal level and on a psychological level, is that Brandon doesn't drink throughout the entire thing. He wants to be in control. Yep. And of course, that last shot, when the police sirens start coming in,
slowly pours
his drink.
Yeah.
And that's a great final moment. He finally has, you know, that's the payoff we get at the end. Is
and
the
then
main
Rupert
character
kind of comes
having...
and sits down and has his gun pointed at them.
Yeah.
I'm in control.
Yeah. That's a beautiful ending.
That's a very good... You can't say last shot because the last shot goes for 10 minutes, but it's a final image.
Yeah.
It's after he shoots the gun out of the window and the camera just pulls back over a period of about...
It's well done. You get the neon lights. And this is Hitchcock's first colour film. I can't believe we haven't mentioned that.
Oh, my God.
So, there's nothing notable, I think, about the colours until towards the end starts coming in. And I think as a director who was playing so much with shadows in his black and white career, and then to make that switch, he hasn't quite discovered the full richness of what that he has at his disposal. But towards the end, when you get those neon lights coming in, it becomes a lot more interesting. But
absolutely.
Let's talk about Hitler.
Yes.
Godwin's Law. Thanks for listening. Bye.
But I mean, so in terms of how somebody's ideas might be taken and distorted, Hitler did I should step back.
It's not such a direct... Here's my thing about...
It's valid and it's in there.
It is. But I think you got to draw along... I know that sounds weird, but you need to step back and look at the dialectics that this film is sort of examining and how they lead to World War II. So this is 3 years after the end of World War II, which destroyed Britain and left America as the superpower.
Everybody knows. Well,
Thinking, so Hitchcock's, place of birth moving, and his adopted homeland. It's a nice...
Is this his first film in America as well?
No. I'm sure it's not.
No.
I don't know what he's... but no, the main point is that they're very much of the modernist leaning of those mesh of ideas. So he's got the modernist artwork in the house, which kind of no one understands. Yeah, there's a real Darwinian sort of philosophy that seems to be. I mean, we never get any core. A real point of reference for Rupert's philosophy, but clearly Darwin and Nietzsche does get a mention.
Nietzsche definitely does get a mention.
They and so does Hitler.
Yeah,
they're clearly the most important influence on Rupert's philosophy. And these were such important ideas in around the 1920s, you know, the modernist era, in shaping, actually before that as well, so going into World War One and World War Two, and it's this idea of the danger and the arrogance of using these ideas to craft a society to your liking.
Mm.
This, of course, and this led to war, and it led to Hitler, and this is the start of the Cold War, so it leads to Stalin. And, you know, the ending speech is such an... It sums up... I should have written it down because I now can't... It's a very long one. I now can't find it on the internet.
Mm.
But the ending speech where he says, "We live in a society where we're free, we're individuals, but we also must take part in that society. Mm. Vote Truman." You know, it feels like he's almost about to burst out with that. It's the perfect post-Roosevelt idea of the free society. We also have responsibilities.
Yeah.
For me, it really ties in and examines what process of thinking leads to a situation like World War II.
Mm.
Not just Hitler, and I think. A modern audience, we look at that time period as Hitler, the evil Hitler. Yeah. But I think to British and American people in that time, they're not going to just be thinking about it like that. They're going to be thinking of the war as an experience and one big literal world experience.
Yeah. And how did that come
about? I think you could easily blame this type of dialectic for it. And this examines it on a smaller level. Mm. It's a microcosm of that conflict of taking good ideas and using them honestly to an extent, but they come out so horribly in the
Yeah, so and also something interesting about this is that because it's made so immediately after the war, I think that a lot of the information about like German methods of propaganda and the angle that they were taking to, you know, ideologically enslave an entire people would have been coming out, and this would have been like a first kind of, you know, American polemical piece against that in a way. Well, I mean, maybe not, but like, in terms of like reaching a wide audience and also being quite experimental and everything, just the way that, you know, it kind of confronts the issues, and then you've got like James Stewart's little kind of speech at the end to kind of just criticize it quite eloquently.
Yeah, it's a great speech, and I think the points are very large, and they.
I want to say my thing about it as well that kind of irked me. Well, just because he's going about, you know, like, we are all equal, you know, there's no way of saying, like, anybody's superior. On what right do you say that you're superior and you have the right to kill any person? And then, like, I know what's going to happen to you. You're going to die. So just after this rousing speech about the worth of human life, he's like, yep, well, society's going to take yours.
I don't think
wherever that... you fall down on the capital punishment debate, it's just kind of a funny way to kind of conclude a speech about the rights of humans to just kind of, you know.
He's not even talking, I think, about, you know, a desire for vengeance. He's talking about, you don't understand the shit you've gotten yourself into. Your little boys, you don't understand like, this, what's comes, coming to you.
Yeah,
I get your difficulty with that statement.
I still like it. I still think it's a valid thing. I think they probably could have chosen a better last sentence, though.
Mm.
And also just kind of, you know, this is... That's probably something that kind of dates a little bit more as well. Just like, I'm not sure how people would have responded to an argument against or for capital punishment in 1948.
Wait, but what? For capital punishment?
Well, just regardless how people kind of thought about it then.
I think that line would have just passed them over. Yeah, exactly. To be honest, if you hadn't brought it up, but America, you're living in your Australian world. America, capital punishment is just the status quo.
Yeah, I know. But so, and also, just like, you know, one of my favorite films is a short film about killing by Kieślowski, and that's just ridiculous. Have you seen it?
No.
You've seen it? Basically, it's kind of just shows you an absolutely brutal murder. And then at the end of it, the murderer is hung.
And, sounds fun.
Oh, it's a very light affair. Yeah. Souffle light.
Souffle like, light. Yeah. That's what Cavaliers du Cinema is patenting the phrase.
Souffle light.
Souffle light.
Yeah, you can put that in an article.
Not to be confused with a light souffle.
As opposed to a heavy souffle. But yeah, no, we are the heavy souffle of cinema criticism.
Yeah. So this is going to wrap up soon, I think.
We've
got more to say, but I'm just saying I think the heavy souffle is an indicator we should probably
I did find that rousing speech cut short by that particular thing because all of a personal quandary with the ethics. I think
you've got a point, but it didn't bother me too much. And I probably stand on the stand at the same point in you on that issue. Well, yeah, it's just no. in that I it washed yeah. over me.
See, also, I mean, just like that's just a personal kind of thing. I'm not saying that weakened any of it. It was almost endearing in a way, and like, you know, the way a racist grandfather is endearing. You know, like it's just like.
No, I wouldn't even make that much of a big deal about it personally. The other thing I want to talk about is that the characters each correspond to an archetype of sort of what's wrong with society and how they're superior.
Yes.
So you've got the inane conversation and this sort of real dumb
with Mrs. Atwater.
who is such an idiot. Such and, a, you know, I thought, why couldn't you kill her? You know, that would have been perfectly just. Yeah. Jimmy Stewart would have opened up. What have you done? Oh, right, it's her. Yeah, whatevs. And then you've got the slut, the harlot, the gold digger. No, I know, it's completely ridiculous. I mean, this is one of the things. Hitchcock doesn't really like women. It's one of the things you have to get past. And it's obviously... And she's one of the more... She's probably the most likable character besides Jimmy Stewart. I think she's the best actor besides... Oh, no. I mean, I think that the main two do give good performances, even if they...
They're for their time, but they do kind of stick out.
Yeah, but I still think they're good. But she has a good role and she's very likable, whereas... But in the context of the film, she's viewed sort of as the slut and the gold digger. I think... And that also is why he wants to manipulate them to get together because he
does feel that superiority.
Yeah, because she's a simple harlot who just wants money from. And then you've got Kenneth, the friend who is blandness personified. Yeah. He's the underwhelming underachiever. He's mediocrity defined. Yeah. He's another point. Another aspect of society that they want to get rid of, that they want to obliterate. Then you've got the father who represents the old guard. He represents conservatism. He's not unintelligent.
He's just a bit of a prude.
Yes, he's a bit of a prude, and he can't comprehend their lofty ideals, you know?
To be fair, his one moment of prudishness was in response to the idea that murder is sport.
Exactly. No, but there is a moment later on where he sort of has the towards Janet. I forget the exact moment, but he clearly has a distaste for her.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And then the maid clearly represents just the pleb.
Yeah.
And there's a scene, there's a brilliant, the maid and Mrs., the aunt.
Atwater.
Are having a conversation. It's the stupidest, most inane, dull conversation. Yeah. Oh, and Brandon separates them. Like he's slicing the mediocre conversation of the plebs in half, you know? It's just, you're bourgeois bullshit and you're sycophantic, proletariat nothingness. I'm just gonna cut it in half. I love that.
The Atwater is ridiculous. Something bit. Oh,
that's a great little meta.
That
bit.
Is so good.
It doesn't need to be there.
It
but
doesn't
I'm glad
need to be
there.
But it is so so great there.
And I think that's all the characters in.
I think
represent.
That's pretty much.
Yeah. And David.
I don't know. Well, he represents dead people. What? I don't know. Well, he's dead, isn't he?
Yeah, that's the twist. He was dead the whole time.
The privileged male Harvard undergrad, in a way. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess. I think him and to a lesser... He's sort of... Him and Mrs... you have said her name many times. During this cast, I've forgotten her name.
Atwater.
I think they both sort of represent...
I kind of see fleeting
bourgeois, you know...
And also
stupidity.
In a way,
I don't want to use the word inane again.
He went to school with Brandon and Phil and everything. And they all went to, you know, school and university together. So it's almost like the cannibalism of that kind of upper echelons of you know, just self-obsessed.
Yeah, and we assume that they probably went to an Ivy League.
Yeah. I mean, they so look it's like the Ivy League the apartment that's
competitive.
Him, you know, just, yeah, absolutely.
And really, this makes him such an asshole because I'm just thinking every fucking sector of society he wants to wipe off the planet. Only, no matter what political view you ascribe to, he will offend you, I think, at least in this day and age. But the reason I think Jimmy Stewart's character, if you see this as a film with a meaning about what life is about, then the reason Jimmy Stewart's character is so successful and we admire him is, yes, he has the bold ideas. Yes, he questions and challenges the status quo. But at the same time, he's the one having fun at the party. This is what he says. I'm the only one having fun. He can kick back and relax. And he genuinely, he does have an affection for his fellow human beings, which also, is what he says at the end. I couldn't do it. Because I just wanted, I love a party now.
Yeah,
fix
he can
me a
draw
drink.
The line between kind of logical masturbation and like stuff that's actually
but,
right
but,
and proper.
But
in the
not
real
even
world.
Not even consciously. I think that's the point. It's just he's a human being as opposed
right
to Brandon, who
yeah.
is there's nothing there. He's soulless and
he does everything for a lol.
He's in it for the lols.
He's in it for the shits and giggles. Like, why did you kill him? For shits and giggles, bro.
That really, I mean, if you were to remake this film and have them a bit younger, the tagline would read, "They killed, full stop, for the lols."
Okay, I think that's pretty much that. I'd just like to talk about the technical side of
yeah,
just
go
the
ahead, go
for
ahead.
Just a moment, because I feel like this is, you know, I mean, there are two really important moments in the long takes history, and that was, you know, the moments when Hitchcock adopted it for this and Orson Welles, who used it so well.
I want to stop you there, because apparently the nature of the long takes in this film was borrowed actually off a TV adaptation of the play.
Oh, right. Well, that doesn't... Yeah, I mean...
That's very interesting.
Yeah, no, I think that's quite valid.
Particularly that they're doing it on TV.
Yeah,
but
that is
odd. Oh, and another amazing scene, amazing shot, and this must have been meticulously rehearsed. And you think about how difficult this would have been to set up, because it's towards the end. He goes in with the rope, and he opens the door and lets it swing, and we see him drop it in.
Oh, that's so good.
And it's
that's
these
so
tableaus that we see, then they disappear. And you think either this is the happiest accident in the history of the film, or it's been so meticulously rehearsed, and he knows exactly what he's doing. And knowing Hitchcock, you know which one it is.
And also, the fact of the matter is, and it's been said a lot about this film, is that when behind the camera or whenever around the camera, just out of frame, constantly you had... just any spare hands that were available, just grabbing, you know, books and grabbing things and just moving things around so that, you know, the shot could be achieved. And I just love that.
We should make our Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of Rogue, where it's just about the crew picking up the shit behind these people.
Oh, man. See, that to me, like,
it's,
that just
it's
makes
ama-
me
it's
so
an amazingly
happy.
Done film.
Yeah, absolutely.
It, as a technical
and I mean,
achievement.
Just
and there's
in,
more
in
going,
that,
but just
that,
on that level.
In that respect, like moving stuff so the camera can get around that kind of foreshadows, like, to me specifically, something as insane as the car shot in Children of Men, where you've got this car moving around. They had like this specially built car so they could move around people's heads, and like they had these chairs that could go down a long way. So
pretty much every car you see in cinema has been altered too.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. But that one scene particularly just reminded me of Rope, just in the way that they would I mean, obviously every long take, but just, you know, I think it was a really, really, really big thing. And I mean, you know, other people had done long takes before, but to do a whole film
of long takes.
That hasn't been repeated until Russian Ark, like just a few years ago.
And I wanted to bring up Russian Ark because I think, you know, Rope is not about the long takes. It is in terms of where its role in sort of cinema history, it's about the long takes. But when you watch it as a film, you're more caught up in the narrative and the tension. You're not going, "Woo, look at the long takes." And when they cut, it's surprisingly unintrusive.
Yeah,
and it's a sharp contrast to Russian Ark, which I think is a bore of a film. I really don't like it.
No, I do. Like,
and I think it's because it uses its technique. It plays that card way too obviously.
I think
look at us and our single take.
I think it's quite obviously somebody like, you know, somebody had a dream and then kind of adapted it into a film. And it's an amazing technical achievement,
but I do not enjoy watching it. And this is an example of how to do that much much subtler, in a much subtler way, and more enjoyable.
I think also, you know, Russian arc is a very specific thing, and you kind of have to have a little bit of an understanding of, you know, Russian history for the last.
Yes, but I have a better understanding of Russian history than you do.
Yeah, I really should get my history.
So if I didn't enjoy it and you did, I think it is a bit of a personal film taste. But anyway, yeah. I think Rope, we've talked about
incredible
it.
Incredible film. Sickening.
It's a great film. Still one of my favorite Hitchcocks. Sickening and stimulating, which is really
Hitchcock in a nutshell.
Yeah, I had to light up a cigarette afterwards, and you know, was it good for you too, Christian?
Oh, that was.
How was it for you? How did you feel during?
That's it.
Okay. All right. Thanks for listening. Once again, you can email us at cavaliersdocinema@gmail.com. Coming up next, as we foreshadowed in our Christopher Nolan.
We think we're going to be going.
I think Aronofsky is definitely a go. So the next director's podcast will be Aronofsky. While this is happening, some fucking music theme is probably amping up.
Wonder what that is right now.
Well, because we record these.
So you're hearing it, but we aren't hearing it.
And
right
then
now.
I'm sure people realize that.
Yeah.
We record these, and then I surprise Christian with our crazy little musical flourishes. He loved the little Dark Knight
Rises. I had a feeling that was going to happen.
Thing at the end of the Christopher Nolan podcast. So,
anyway. I was hoping you might use time from Inception, but no.
No,
you don't
I had to build up and then end with the most inane phrase we could. Have a good one.
So I think I'm just going to end with that one again. So yeah, thanks for listening, everybody, and have a good one.
Thanks.